From national news in D.C. to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol, this is your Capitol Connection. And now, bringing the Capitol to you, here's your host, Nate Groz.
And welcome to the program. Today is a big day on the show because I have a leading national expert joining me for the majority of the program today, an extremely special guest, Ryan Anderson, who is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. And if you don't know Ryan Anderson, basically he is the Michael Jordan of social conservatism. He has become essentially the face and go-to figure for defending both traditional marriage and religious freedom. He does amazing work researching and writing about marriage, bioethics, religious liberty, and political philosophy. He is also the founder and editor of the Witherspoon Institute's online journal, The Public Discourse, and he has authored several best-selling books. Not to mention that his research has actually been cited by two U.S. Supreme Court justices in separate cases. So in other words, he knows what he's talking about and has been one of the most sought-after scholars on religious freedom. He has been on all the major networks defending traditional marriage, and he does so with grace and class. And he has a new book out called Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination. And that's the big debate being had all across the country right now. Is religious liberty really just discrimination? How should we think about and talk about this issue? It's essential to have a deep understanding of what religious liberty is and why it matters, because it affects everyone, religious or not, and we have to be prepared to defend it. So I'm pleased to have joining me on the program now, Ryan T. Anderson, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation and author of several best-selling books, including his latest, Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination. Ryan, to me and many others, you have really been the leading voice for defending traditional marriage and religious freedom. So it's a great privilege to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be with you.
Ryan, my first question, you've really become sort of the face and go-to policy expert for defending traditional marriage and religious freedom. What has that journey been like for you personally over especially these last 2 years to step so far out into the public spotlight when, to some people and most media outlets, you're not the good guy in these debates?
Well, it's definitely been an interesting experience, somewhat unexpected, because I would have never thought that simply defending the truth would be so controversial. I'm not particularly a bomb thrower or kind of, the type of guy that tries to get, like, shock value and saying things in an over-the-top way. I just more or less try to make good arguments in defense of the truth, and whether it be about marriage, about life, now about religious liberty, about gender identity. And so it's been somewhat interesting, somewhat surprising to see how some people really recoil from that. They don't want to hear it. And the way that they try to get around it is simply by saying, well, no, what you're saying is actually hate. What you're saying is discrimination. What you're saying is, you know, fill in the blank. They don't want to be open to some of these arguments.
Right. And so Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination, that's the title of your latest book, and it's an issue that is perhaps more relevant than ever. I know you've written literally an entire book about this, but for the sake of our conversation, how do you define religious liberty?
Sure. So, I mean, religious liberty is more or less the freedom that citizens have to seek out the truth about God and to respond to God as they understand that truth and as they understand that God. It's conditioned by certain side constraints. You can't harm other people in your pursuit and living out of the truth about God. You can't violate other people's rights. You can't harm the common good or justice. But apart from those side constraints, citizens have a pretty large area to exercise their right of the free exercise of religion to answer those questions for themselves. I like to tell people that you don't want me telling you how to lead your religious life. I don't want you telling me how to lead my religious life. And none of us want the government telling us how to lead our religious lives. Religious liberty is about protecting that space, that freedom, for each and every one of us to make these decisions for ourselves.
That's a great definition. And so debating religious liberty and discrimination is actually a point-counterpoint book in which both sides of the argument are represented, and you make the case for a defense of liberty more broadly, a return to limited government and the rule of law. How do you respond to the counterpoint to that what Christians are really asking for is religious privilege or the ability to do whatever they want in the name of religion?
Sure. So no one's really making that argument. I mean, more or less, the argument here is that government is regulating more aspects of our lives than they should, and they're doing it not to help protect the common good and for a compelling government purpose in the least restrictive way possible, to use kind of the lawyer's jargon here. They're doing it simply to impose progressive social and moral values on everyone else. So you think about, why do the Little Sisters of the Poor need to provide coverage for contraception in their health care plan? You know, what's the compelling state interest in making the Little Sisters of the Poor provide coverage of contraception? They're nuns. How is it the least restrictive way possible to make the nuns do this? It's only a sense in which you're saying, no, the reason that government's doing this is because they want to be imposing progressive sexual values on the rest of America. Would you arrive at a situation in which you're saying, oh, if we exempt the nuns, that's religious privilege? I mean, who would have thought that allowing Roman Catholic nuns to live out Roman Catholic teaching about sex and marriage and abortion and contraception is a privilege, right? The founders would have said, this is a right. This is a natural right that Roman Catholic nuns get to be authentically Catholic. And so it's only when you have a bad understanding of the role of the state, a bad understanding of sexual values, and a bad understanding of what religious liberty is, do you then conclude that this is actually religious privilege when we say we're just going to leave the nuns alone.
It seems that to a lot of people, religious liberty means you can believe whatever you want, and that's fine, but you don't get to take those beliefs with you to work or if they affect other people. How should Christians and conservatives communicate to those people that religious freedom isn't something that should be confined to just your home or within the walls of a church on Sunday morning?
Yeah, so I mean, religious liberty is going to be what the founders described as the free exercise of religion, which means it's the ability to live out your faith 7 days a week, not just Sunday morning inside the four walls of a chapel, not just early in the morning in your bedroom when you do your devotional or late at night when you're at home. This is really going to be the freedom to live this out in all aspects of your lives, your business, your school, your charity, your recreational activities. Because if you think about it, Jesus is Lord of all. So if you're coming at this from a Christian perspective and you're following Jesus, he wants you to follow him not just inside of the chapel, but every day of the week. And other religious traditions have those same sorts of principles. They don't cabin religious practice and faith and exercise. So if you're a Jew, you're supposed to be a Jew every day of the week, 24 hours a day. And that's why religious liberty isn't simply freedom of worship. One of the problems that we heard during the Obama administration was that the free exercise of religion had been redefined as merely the freedom of worship. But that gets the nature of religion wrong, because religion isn't just about worship. Religion includes worship, but it also includes discipleship. It includes living your life in conformity with what you believe to be God's requirements. And we disagree about that, right? We're a country that has Jews and Catholics and Protestants and Mormons and Muslims. And we need to be able to agree to disagree about what religious truth is and protect people's rights to live their lives in accordance with what they believe to be the truth about God, not what you or I believe to be the truth about God.
So when people, including the U.S. Civil Rights Commission just last year, equate religious liberty with discrimination and intolerance, what are they missing?
Well, so part of the problem here is that they're imputing the worst of motives to the people with whom they disagree. So they will say that by definition, if you're against abortion, it's because you hate women. If you're against gay marriage, it's because you hate gay people. So they're they're not looking sympathetically at what actually motivates the pro-life doctor who won't perform an abortion. What motivates the traditional marriage supporter who can't do a same-sex wedding cake? They're not looking at what actually motivates them. They're simply imputing bad motives on them. So if you think about what actually motivates a pro-life doctor, the pro-life doctor says, I believe in the dignity of unborn human life, therefore I can't kill an unborn child. It's not because of patriarchy. It's not because of views that women are less than human or anything like that. In the same way, the florist, Baronelle Stutzman, who says, I can't do a same-sex wedding flower bouquet arrangement, but I have no problem employing gay people. I have no problem doing happy birthday flowers, get well soon flowers. She's not coming at this because she's anti-gay. She's coming at this because she has a sincere belief that marriage unites man and woman, husband and wife, mother and father. And so it's only when we impute bad motives to people with whom we disagree that we get into the situation in which we say the exercise of religious liberty is actually discrimination.
And one area where we really see this particularly become conflict is when we're dealing with sexual orientation and gender identity non-discrimination laws, which on their face sound very appealing to everyone because no one likes discrimination. So how should people respond to claims that they are bigoted and against equality if they don't support these measures?
Well, I mean, I think you actually just want to deny the premise. You want to say that we think gay and lesbian citizens should be free to live how they want to, but we also think that evangelicals and Catholics and Mormons and Muslims and Jews should be free to live how they want to. And if that means that the evangelical grandmother doesn't want to do wedding flowers, then that's her right. If that means that a secularist florist wants to do the wedding flowers, then that's his right. We have to agree to disagree. And we can't simply label every disagreement as discrimination.
Ryan, what in your mind right now is the greatest threat to religious liberty in the United States, and how do we combat that moving forward?
So I would say that there are three. So I'm not going to give you the greatest threat. I'll say there are three. One is the growth of government. We need to return to limited constitutional government, because the more the government regulates, the greater the likelihood that it violates someone's religious liberty. Second is the sexual revolution. If you want to know why the ACLU is bad on certain religious liberty claims, it's because they've taken sides and that they prefer sexual revolution over religious liberty. That's why they're against religious liberty when it comes to Catholic hospitals that won't do sex reassignment surgeries or Catholic hospitals that won't do abortion. They're against religious liberty when it's the evangelical owners of Hobby Lobby that won't provide coverage for abortion, or the evangelical florist who won't do a same-sex a wedding bouquet. Sexual revolution is one of the big threats. And then the third threat is a devaluing of religion itself. We protect the liberties that we care most about, and as people have grown to care less about religion, they've grown to care less about religious liberty. So we have to respond on all three of those fronts.
So how can we move from a defensive posture of just defending religious freedom to actually advancing it in our culture and our society?
Well, I mean, so part of this is simply helping to educate people about why it matters. Why, even if you're not religious yourself, you want to live in a society that respects the religious liberty of other people. That this is a more tolerant society, this is a more diverse society, this is a society that does pluralism well, this is a society that recognizes and respects other civil liberties, other human rights. Societies that respect religious liberty are better on all of those grounds. This is also a society that can live and let live. A society that protects religious liberty well is one that can say we can disagree about the most important things in life, and yet still be civil with one another, still be fellow citizens. And then lastly, defend religious liberty by saying, look, religious institutions are the ones that are best equipped to help the people who are in most in need of help. If we shut down Catholic adoption agencies or Catholic schools, if we shut down Mormon LDS relief services or Lutheran church relief services, who are we hurting the most? We're hurting the people who benefit from these charities. Government's actually not very good at taking care of the least among us. But these religious charities are, and protecting their freedom to operate isn't just important for them, but it's important for all of the people whom they help.
And as you well know, really under the Obama administration is when we saw a lot of these new threats to religious freedom really come to the surface. But now we have a new president and a new administration. What's your impression so far of President Trump and his administration and their understanding of religious freedom?
So this has really been a mixed bag. Because some of his rhetoric has been encouraging, some of his rhetoric has been bad. So he said very nice things about the Little Sisters of the Poor, for example, but he said some really troubling things about the religious liberty rights of non-Christians, Muslims in particular. We want to make clear that religious liberty is a freedom for all Americans, regardless of whether or not they pass our theological orthodoxy test. So his rhetoric's been a mixed bag. So too has his policies. So he has said nice things about the Little Sisters of the Poor, but 200 days into his presidency, he still hasn't revoked the HHS contraception mandate. The Little Sisters of the Poor are still in court. He hasn't actually protected their religious liberty rights. And twice now, when there have been draft executive orders on religious liberty that would have protected the Little Sisters of the Poor and that would have protected people who believe that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, those were leaked, and then they got watered down. The protections got rolled back. And according to the media narrative, it's been his daughter and son-in-law who have objected to this, saying that, Dad, if you do that, you'll be anti-woman, you'll be anti-gay. So the rhetoric has been a mixed bag, and then the actions have been a mixed bag.
And so certainly there's things that can and should be done through government. My next question is, is there something more that the church should be doing? What is the role of pastors in educating their congregation about the need to defend and really champion the good and the beauty of religious liberty?
Sure. I mean, so pastors should be preaching on this just like they would any other human rights issue. They need to be helping their congregants understand that it's God's will that we not persecute one another in the name of God's will. They need to understand that the limit of governmental authority is that while we should render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, we shouldn't be rendering them the things that are God's. We have to render to God the things that are God's. So in both of those cases, having a proper understanding of the domain of Caesar and the domain of God, and when Caesar is overstepping its boundaries, and then also understanding how we should relate to people who we disagree with about God. That it's God's will that we not kill each other in the name of God's will, that we not persecute each other, that we not penalize each other. This requires preaching and teaching and formation. It doesn't just grow organically.
That's a message that more people need to hear. And Ryan, I wish we could continue this discussion for an hour because it's important, but I know you have to be moving on here. So my last question for you is, I've seen you go on CNN and all the mainstream media outlets defending traditional marriage and religious freedom in very hostile environments. And in many of these instances, you're the only one with our position in an entire room full of people. But yet in every interview, you remain calm, level-headed, and well-spoken while the hosts and other commentators are berating you and trying to vilify you. How do you remain so calm and reasoned in all of these emotionally charged and frustrating scenarios?
Well, I drink a lot. That's the joke answer. I'm glad you chuckled. I once said that, and the host sounded scandalized. No, so that's not the serious answer. But I would say two things. One is that in hindsight, I can actually see how providentially I've been prepared for this. I grew up one of five boys. My poor mom always wanted to have a daughter. She got five sons instead. I'm number four of the five boys. So we argued a lot at dinner and when we were playing. And so you just got used to holding your own in a disagreement. And, you know, the Piers Morgan interview that I was conducted a couple years ago, Piers Morgan interviewed me on his CNN show. That was just like Sunday dinner growing up. So I had these good experiences, and I went to a very liberal Quaker school for 12 years, first through 12th grade. I was one of the only people who had a kind of conservative values in the entire school. So I'm used to having friends who disagree with me and being able to explain why I believe what I believe without getting hot under the collar. And then the second thing I'll say is that, you know, before I do these TV interviews, before I do debates on college campuses, I just say a quick prayer and I ask for the grace to bear witness to the truth in a way that will be accessible to my audience. Because the point of this is not to kind of prove how smart I am. It's not to kind of do a combat against other people. That's not what God wants me doing in my vocation. What he wants me doing is helping other people come to know and embrace the truth. And the only way we can effectively do that is if we're doing it out of charity and if we do it with civility. And so the prayer I say there is just that I'll be doing that. I don't want to actually be harming the causes that I care most about.
Well, you have been a great witness and example for us all. Debating Religious Liberty and Discrimination, you can buy it on Amazon. It's a must-read for every conservative and Christian to better understand this issue, and it's crucial that we do. So, Ryan, thank you for coming on the show and being such a tremendous advocate for religious freedom.
Thank you.
Well, no one puts it all together better than Ryan Anderson. What a tremendous opportunity to hear directly from him today. And religious freedom is an especially important topic right now because nearly 300,000 students are back in public school. And a frequent and common question during this time of year is, what are my child's religious rights in a public school? And simply put, you don't have to abandon your First Amendment rights when you leave your home and arrive at the schoolhouse gate. And this is something that goes for both teachers and students. You don't lose your constitutionally protected freedoms in a public school. But many times the line isn't clear on what is or isn't acceptable or allowed in schools. So Nebraska Family Alliance has put together a list of five key religious rights that every student in a public school should know. So if you are a parent or a grandparent with a student in a public school, or you are a teacher or a student yourself, if you visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org, you will see it on the blog and on the homepage. And so these five rights, first and foremost, many people don't know this, you do have the right to pray in public school. Every student has the right to pray, discuss their faith, read scripture, and even distribute literature. They can do all of this as long as it is voluntary and non-disruptive or coercive, and it occurs during non-instructional time, so not during class time, but you can still do all of those things at a public school. And secondly, you have the right to express your religious views. Students have the ability to express their views during class discussion or as part of their written assignments or homework, just so long as it's relevant to the subject matter and meets the requirements of the assignment. And third, and this has been one that has caused a lot of problems recently, is the right to form religious clubs. Secondary school students do have the right to form religious clubs as long as that school also allows other non-curriculum related clubs to meet also. So it has to be a level playing field. If you can have non-religious clubs, you can also have religious clubs. They just need to be student-led. And teachers can be present, they just can't lead the club. And fourth, the right to wear religious attire. Students have the right to wear religious attire required by their religion, such as headscarves or yarmulkes or jewelry. And fifth and final, to sum it all up, the right to not be required to violate their religious beliefs. Students have the right to not be required to violate their personal, sincerely held religious beliefs. This means that students cannot be forced to participate in lessons or assignments or learning material that the student or the student's parents have objections to on religious grounds. And so be sure to visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org for this resource. It's important for every student to know their religious rights as they go back to school. And as Ryan Anderson said earlier on the program, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, give to God the things that are God's, but don't give to Caesar the things that are God's. I'll be back next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.